Welcome to Fred Tromberg on Life, the Law, and Legal Issues, brought to you by Pure Radio. Fred Tromberg is a Florida Bar Board certified civil trial attorney with over 40 years of experience as a lawyer practicing in Jacksonville and Northeast Florida. Mr. Tromberg is a board certified civil trial attorney specializing in civil trial law. His specialty areas of practice include automobile and truck accidents, medical and hospital mistakes and malpractice, nursing home mistakes and abuse, sexual assaults, inadequate security, wrongful death, and all cases involving civil litigation. Tune in now for a timely discussion of important issues that affect you as a medical and legal consumer. Mr. Tromberg also regularly has guests on a wide variety of topics ranging from writers and authors to environmentalists and government officials. You can reach him by email at tromberglaw@bellsouth.net or by telephone at 904-396-5321. You
Hi, this is Fred Tromberg, your host on Life, the Law, and Legal Issues. A special welcome to all of you listening to the show today. We are glad to know you're out there listening. Thanks so much for tuning in, and thanks for staying tuned in. Welcome to all of you listening by simulcast on PureRadioJax.org, with a listening range of the entire United States and around the world. En español, bienvenidos, en francés, bienvenue. In Japanese, konnichiwa. In Hebrew, shalom. In German, willkommen, and in Italian, my old neighborhood, bienvenuto, mi piace molto, mille grazie. My special guest this week is Professor Jay Tischfield, who's a distinguished professor of genetics, pediatrics, and psychiatry at Rutgers, the State University of New Jersey. He's also the executive director of the Human Genetics Institute of New Jersey. Jay has been a scientist specializing in genomics and biomedicine for his entire career. He's recognized nationally and internationally for his work in genetics and the biomedical sciences. We'll be discussing COVID-19, the pandemic, looking at the science, and further discussing the effect of the virus on our country, especially as we talk about the topics of testing, tracing, and working towards a vaccine, as well as therapeutics. Jay, thank you so much for being on the show today. We welcome you, and we're so grateful you took the time out to talk with us.
My pleasure, Fred. Great to be here.
Oh, you can't imagine. Thanks for reaching out, and thanks for making sure that you made it during this pandemic. We appreciate it.
My pleasure.
Jay, let's talk a couple of minutes about what this novel, I underline the word novel, virus is. It's not the first. It's not the last. I understand it's called the coronavirus. In simple terms, what is all that about? Can you explain it to us?
Yeah. Coronavirus is a rather simple virus. Instead of DNA as their genetic material, they have something called RNA. Doesn't really matter from a pandemic point of view. Coronaviruses cause about 30% of the common colds, but it's not the same coronavirus that causes the current pandemic, COVID-19. It's a different coronavirus called SARS-CoV-2, and it's novel. It was first seen.
And novel, if I understand it, means it's new.
Yes, yes. We hadn't seen it before. It probably originated 6 or 8 months ago in from infection from bats, probably in China. The evidence, I think, is pretty good that bats were the original host. And somehow it got into humans, and it was able to multiply, and it infected many people. And we had an epidemic, and then that turned into a pandemic.
And so how does that pandemic translate for the rest of us in this world who are not scientists? How does that translate into something that we do understand, which is the beginning of a disease and then the end of it being this much of a threat, the end of a pandemic? What's the normal course of a virus? We know about the 1918 terrible epidemic. That viral epidemic killed millions of people worldwide. Spanish flu is what they called it. What is the course of this one? What's the trajectory of this one?
Well, it's difficult to predict the future. This virus has a life cycle in terms of whether or not people initially have symptoms once they're infected and how often they spread it. It's a very infectious virus, meaning if you have it, there's a high likelihood that people you come in close contact will get it from you. That's one of the problems. I don't know how long this virus is going to hang around. A lot of that has to do with how well we control it at this point. We have to get this pandemic under control.
So I've read about the elements of dealing with it. They say that the toolbox is full of tools, one of which is a mask, mm-hmm. second is social distancing, third of which is a vaccine that they're working on. I know they're working on a lot of different types of vaccines.
That's right.
And then fourth is tracing. Have I left anything out?
No, that's basically it. But the simplest thing we can do is some degree of social isolation, masks, and contact tracing. And that
let's
means
talk about,
testing.
I want to make sure we talk about what is contact tracing.
Well, contact tracing is if you turn up positive on a test, they can determine who you had contact with and notify them to get a test and isolate until they get their test results.
And just so we understand how that works, contact, when they say contact tracing, means being in close proximity with somebody.
Yeah, it doesn't mean passing them on the street. It means speaking with them, any kind of touching.
Okay, so that would be to determine if the family, and I assume we got mom, dad, and two kids. The kids have to be asked, who did you contact? Who did you have anything to do with?
Initially, the kids have to be tested. If the kids are negative, then that's no issue. We don't need to know who they had contact with.
Well, it brings up a bigger issue, though, because it's kind of like the headline issue right now, and that's whether children should be going back to school in the next month or two. And I have a question about that. Little kids, obviously, and you've got kids, I've got kids. We mm-hmm. know when they're 5, 6, 7, 8 years old, they're like little tiger cubs. They're all over each other.
Yeah.
You can't keep masks on them, and you can't keep social distancing in effect. What do you do when it comes to dealing with kids in school?
That is a very difficult question, and there are many opinions on it because obviously there's a real need to keep kids in school, and that has to be weighed against the possibility of their spreading the pandemic. I don't think there's anything you can do with five-year-olds in terms of masks or separating them. I think you can test them, you can test the teachers too. And you have to do it at very regular intervals, like some of the big U.S. corporations are doing, for example, even once or twice a week. And, you know, there are certain situations like special ed where you really need teachers in a room. And I think we should reserve that heavyweight testing at this point for those kinds of situations and get those kids back in environments where they can learn. But for kids that don't have special needs, I think we have to seriously consider whether it's wise to send them back.
And that's a parental decision, correct?
Well, no, it's a public health decision, in my view. It's a public health decision not to allow smoking in bars, movie theaters, and such. I think this is part of the politicization of the whole pandemic thing. I regard all the decisions that have to be made as public health decisions.
All right. And I can understand why. You're a scientist and you've been involved in biomedicine all your entire adult career. But from the perspective of the mom and dad who are thinking, can we send our 5-year-old and 7-year-old kids to school? They have to be thinking, well, you know what? They're a whole lot safer here. It might be better to do either homeschooling or virtual mm-hmm. schooling, because even if they're tested And they, the kids themselves don't have any kind of serious symptoms. They're asymptomatic. They still will be bringing home the virus if they're positive. And, you know, grandma and grandpa can get it yes. right here.
Yeah, we have many multi-generational families. And let me be clear on this. I wasn't indicating that parents should send kids to school if they don't think it's in their best interest.
Right. I get it.
I'm not suggesting that for a moment. I just think sometimes school is in the best interest of both the parents and the kids. And under those circumstances, there are ways we can in which we can be cautious, like
right,
testing.
Let's talk about that, because once the virus shows up in the child and the child is positive, even though the child doesn't have any symptoms, we call that being asymptomatic, correct?
More or less, yeah.
They can still spread the virus, can't they?
Right. There are two circumstances, apparently, that a person, child, could be asymptomatic. Generally, people start shedding virus before they show clinical symptoms like fever. So there's that period before they show clinical symptoms. It could be 3 days, for example, that they can infect others, but they don't know they're sick. And then there are people who are truly asymptomatic. They keep producing virus, but they have no symptoms of COVID-19 disease.
So here's a question for you, because you are a geneticist and you have spent much of your professional life in genetics. Is a particular kind of individual more susceptible, that is, with a particular blood type or skin color or hair color or eye color? Is there somebody who's less susceptible? How does that work?
Okay. Yeah. First of all, we don't know. The list of things we don't know about this virus exceeds the list of things we do know.
Jay, I've never had the opportunity on the radio to say this before, but I at the risk of sounding like Donald Rumsfeld, are you telling me that we don't know what we don't know?
Yep, we don't know what we don't know.
Wow.
There are known unknowns and unknown unknowns.
There you go.
There you go. Exactly.
So as a geneticist, tell me your approach to looking at this.
All right. So a lot of people actually are investigating this. So there is some evidence that the A blood group, for example, is somewhat more susceptible. But these are small differences. People with all blood groups get COVID-19. There's also overwhelming evidence that the incidence of the disease is higher in the African American and Latino communities. And let me
just interrupt for a moment, mm-hmm, because sure. I'm interested in how does science explain that? How do scientists understand that and extrapolate? What do we get from that?
Well, it isn't clear that it has anything to do with the ethnicity of these folks. I'm not saying it doesn't, but it isn't clear whether or not that's the case. I suspect that's not the case, because Latinos as a group and African Americans don't have a common ethnicity in general. But there's a lack of health care, a lack of prevention. Diet is different. Living in one of the things we've learned is living in a place, a city, a zone of the city that has higher levels of air pollution is one of the factors that predicates toward COVID-19. If you live in air pollution, you are more likely to get COVID-19. So it may be an environmental issue.
We're going to break for station identification, Jay, but when we come back, I got a question for you. And that is, and I'm sure you've heard this before, this is probably not the first time this world of ours has been hit by a virus. It's probably not the last time. I want to know what lessons learned we can take away and what the new normal will be from those lessons once we find a vaccine to deal with this terrible scourge. But if you're just joining us, this is Fred Tromberg on Life, the Law, and Legal Issues. Our special guest today is Jay Tischfeld, Distinguished Professor of Genetics, Pediatrics, and Psychiatry at Rutgers, the State University of New Jersey. He's a biomedical and genetics expert, and he's sharing his views with us today on the COVID-19 pandemic. You're listening to Pure Radio on 103.7 FM, 1320 AM, and today we are simulcasting worldwide on PureRadioJax.org. Bienvenidos, everyone. Jay, let me get back to the question, and that is, it's not the first time we've had to deal with a virus, although I don't remember anything close to what we're dealing with now in my lifetime, in your lifetime.
There is nothing.
And it probably is not going to be the last, and I'm just speculating as a layman now. Am I correct about that?
I think you're right, unfortunately.
So that leads us to lessons learned, and I'll just let you have the infrastructure here to go ahead and build.
Well, the first thing, there probably are other viruses that are in animals and that could be transmitted to humans. And as humans encroach on the environments of these animals, the likelihood of getting infected increases. What we need every time there's a new infection is to stamp it out quickly. And that means we need a policy. We can't depend on decisions made by leaders. They could be wrong. They could be political. We need a policy when there's a certain level of virus in the community. It needs to be recognized. We need to understand how infectious it is. We need to understand what we can do and how we can test for it. That means we need to build up our public health infrastructure. CDC is a wonderful place. They need funding. The things that one has to do with a novel virus that could potentially cause a pandemic should be automatic. Some countries that put distancing and put masks and put contact tracing in place had less than 1/1000th of the deaths that we've had, because they acted promptly and they acted appropriately. We have to have a plan that's policy that enacts such events in the event of another viral attack, so it doesn't become a pandemic.
I'm assuming the Pentagon, the National Institute of Health, the CDC, I'm assuming that these are entities that come up with plans and contingent plans for just about every kind of disease. Am I correct about that?
Well, you are, but there's been a lack of coordination and national policy on this issue. You know, we spend, I heard, $7 trillion on defense, but a virus we can't see can do more damage to our military, look what it did to that aircraft carrier and its crew, than our enemies can. So this is a Pentagon issue, this is a CDC issue, and it's certainly a National Institutes of Health issue.
Well, I'm going to take a wild guess that you have had hundreds, if not thousands, of scientists studying under you over the years.
Well, hundreds at any rate.
As a professor, where you have been teaching biomedical sciences and genetics to all these leaders of today and tomorrow. So the question is, if they're Tischfield trained, what are they supposed to do to prepare for the next one? Shouldn't they be thinking, you know, we need to learn some lessons here. We need to get a lot more masks. We need to go ahead and get PPE ready. We need to go ahead and start thinking about vaccines. We need to be thinking about pre-production. What can we do in a coordinated way? And simplify it for us. Give us a summary to prepare for the future.
I think there's a bit of confusion in your question about what scientists do and what medical administrators do.
Okay, go ahead and clarify.
I mean, medical administrators, experts in public health, they're the guys who have to make sure we have adequate supplies of masks, respirators, and various protective equipment. This has been a very serious problem. They also have to make sure that we have the reagents and the machines that are necessary to do testing for the virus.
Explain what a reagent is.
A reagent is just a chemical. It's something you add to the swab or the spit that you take as a sample, and then you put it in a machine, and the machine tells you whether or not the sample is virus positive. But these are highly specialized things, and we didn't have nearly the quantities we needed for this pandemic. That's why testing is so far behind in some states.
I know that you have a great deal of expertise in the testing part of it. Mm-hmm. Would you share your observations, not just the opinions, but the facts that you base them on, about how well we have done testing, what more can we do, and why it's such an important component of this whole program?
Well, overall, as a country, testing has been a disaster.
Well, that's pretty strong. That's really strong language, Jay. I mean, tell us why.
The last few months have been extraordinarily painful for me to watch what we're going through. There were very few laboratories who could do the numbers of tests that we'd be talking about. We're talking about millions of tests per day, potentially. It's estimated we need 2 million tests a day if we're going to do serious testing and contact tracing, and that these tests have to come back within 24 to 48 hours. I know a lot of folks who've been tested in various parts of the country who had to wait 12 days to get their results. And that's because the whole system is uncoordinated, inefficient, not managed on a governmental level. There are some things that governments do well, and public health is one of them. We have an ample history of public health, that we've wiped out polio and other diseases. That was a national effort, and we have to have a national effort toward this viral disease and future viral diseases. We have to be prepared. We were unprepared. The president has not invoked, I think it's called the Defense Production Act, to have reagents and testing gear produced. I think it's past time to do that. Many states have anywhere from 10 to 25% of the testing that they need. Only a few of the northeastern states, New Jersey, New York, Connecticut, and a couple others, have adequate testing. It's very, very difficult. The government needs to have a clear policy that can be implemented very quickly. And it shouldn't involve what the president says, because the president is not an expert in public health.
Well, let's say you get a conference call later this afternoon. I realize my call here today and my show is the highlight of your day, but let's just assume
it is.
The next call you get this afternoon is from, the CDC and the NIH and the Pentagon. There's a conference call to Professor Tischfeld, and here's the question they ask of you. Professor, we don't have a lot of time. We just need to know your top three suggestions on what we do to improve and enhance and get the program for testing going. Should we use these swabs? Should we use these blood tests? How best do we go ahead and harness the energies that we have and try to make up for some of our shortcomings?
We don't know enough about the utility of the blood test, which tests whether you've been infected, not whether you're currently infected. So that's a separate issue. I don't think whether saliva or swabs, they're equally good as far as we can determine. Saliva is easier to collect from the point of view of the people doing the collection. They don't have to wear a lot of personal gear, and they don't have to have contact with the patient. The patient can sit in their car, for example, and spit into the little tube, or they can even do it at home. There's approval for that by the FDA. We need much more tests. We need much greater quantities of the chemicals, the reagents that go in to the testing. We need a plan for those states that are having the greatest outbreaks. I read where Arizona was over 25% positive, and Florida was something like 12 or 13%.
Correct.
New Jersey's got it down to 1% with a lockdown and masks. And people are serious about it, I notice. So we have to get testing. We have to get enough contact tracers. And mainly, we have to get a public health message out to people that this is serious. If you don't do this, people will die. And they won't only be old people. They'll be also young people, although obviously it affects old people worse than younger people. I don't think people take this seriously. And that's because our leadership hasn't been giving out a serious message.
And so what is the Professor Jay Tischfield message on masks?
Absolutely, always. When you're around people, I mean, you don't need a mask when you're running and unless there are tons of people around or bicycling or anything like that, or fishing or whatever. But if there are other people around, you must always wear a mask and wash your hands frequently. That'll keep it from spreading if you touch something. We don't believe the virus is transmitted primarily from surfaces, but we know it can be transmitted that way. We believe it's mostly transmitted in aerosols, droplets from people speaking, droplets of saliva that you can see with special cameras and things.
So let me ask you a non-scientific question that I'm very interested in. I live down here in Florida with my whole family, extended family, and restaurants are open at 50% capacity. What about the air conditioning and the ceiling fans that we have in our restaurants? You can't go into a restaurant that's not air conditioned.
Yeah, no, I understand that. There are some, unfortunately, there are some cases where literally it was swept down the length of the restaurant and infected people. A lot depends on the air conditioning and the nature of the airflow in the restaurants. I think in general, indoor dining, if the incidence of the disease is high, is a bad idea. Outdoor dining is another story. If the distance is sufficient, it's probably okay. But it's very different having indoor dining in New Jersey where the incidence is 1% versus indoor dining in another place where it's perhaps 10 or 15%. That means 1 out of 10 people or even more might spread the virus. And if you have 10 people in the restaurant, what are the odds?
Well, Jay, this half hour has flown by, and I told you it would.
Yep.
I want to thank you again for being here today, Jay. I know our listeners appreciate you taking the time to talk with us.
It's great to be here.
In the 90 seconds that we have, that's all we got, a minute and a half for a wrap-up. What's the takeaway on the pandemic crisis, this terrible COVID-19 crisis of 2020, from your perspective as a scientist?
I think this is a wake-up call for the future. Not only do we have to get serious, very serious, about dealing with this now, or another 100,000 or more people could die, but we have to have a plan in place. We have plans in place for the military in case we're attacked. We need a serious plan in place in case we're attacked by another virus. In the future, we have to have detection early, we have to have screening, and we have to have testing.
And what can we do as individuals, as parents and grandparents? What do you recommend? What's your biggest single recommendation to all of us?
To teach your children that information on things like pandemics should come from scientists and people who have some expertise in the subject. And we should use science information as a guide to what we do rather than instinct.
You're saying that science is the cornerstone of leadership.
Science is knowledge, and knowledge is the cornerstone of leadership. Correct.
Jay, thank you so much. Our guest has been Professor Jay Tischfield, a nationally recognized bioscience expert who has shared his thoughts with us on the COVID-19 pandemic. I want to thank our engineer, Terry Robinson. Thank you, Terry, keeping all those moving parts moving and together. Thank you to our producer, Kathleen Neal. She's doing the same thing behind the scenes, keeping it all together. As Albert Einstein has said, there are only two ways to live your life. One is as though nothing is a miracle. The other is as though everything is miraculous. I'm in group two. Hope you are as well. Till next time, when I get to see you on the radio, Thanks so much for listening. Stay healthy, stay safe, and stay home. Thanks so much. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to Fred Tromberg on Life, the Law, and Legal Issues, brought to you by Pure Radio. Mr. Tromberg is a board-certified civil trial attorney specializing in civil trial law. His specialty areas of practice include automobile and truck accidents, medical and hospital mistakes and malpractice, nursing home mistakes and abuse, sexual assaults, inadequate security, wrongful death, and all cases involving civil litigation. The law offices of Fred Tromberg are located at 4925 Beach Boulevard. Call 904-396-5321 for a free consultation. Find them online at fredtromberg.com. Tune in Mondays and Fridays for Fred Tromberg on Life, the Law, and Legal Issues.